Session number 30109.
The Candlish Reel
2.
You returned to the UK. What was the next
thing? Basically, you come back and go on leave.
When you came back?
Okay, well, obviously, came back, leave, which is nice. So the summer leave was probably about due anyway. I mean, a week or so was extra leave for being on the deployment. And really, from 40 to 100 in those days was actually good for the next sort of, for that period, that year, and the following year and a bit as well, because we always seemed to be going away, mainly on exercises rather than operations. But so back in the 74, we got prepped for a trip to Ireland in the start of 75. So, I mean, in the preparation for a Northern Ireland tour takes a good fair bit of your time. We deployed off to Northern Ireland in March or April of 75, I think.
Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, I mean, obviously that was another first for me. I mean, a good number of the guys had already been there, but of course it was my first opportunity. We did a deployment to West Belfast, to Andersonstown, again still with Bravo Company as one of the radio guys. It was quite an eye opener, because I think it was probably early enough in the troubles that were occurring that you know, we had riots still took place on the streets. There were still shootings and bombings potentially occurring, and there was still probably a fairly aggressive stance by the military as well in terms of its searches and the manner in which we'd go and search various suspect properties or locations within the city. And yet at the same time, you saw the hearts and minds aspect of what we were trying to do as well. It would go right back to the thinking man soldier. You know, that was played very hard to the way it was put across by the guys, how they treated people on the streets, that they, you know, they weren't the enemy, so to speak. I mean, most people in Northern Ireland are normal, God-fearing, ordinary people. And you can only antagonize the situation. You just keep, if you go too hard at them, you need to win a degree of their support to actually help defeat the terrorism side of it. And that was good. It's laid on little things that would get I've got sort of Irish heritage as well in my background on my mother's side, so I've got a grave understanding of the situation. And you get things like when we organised for all the local kids from one of the local schools to be going off down to Loch Ness to go kayaking and all these things, a bit of an adventure sports type of thing. The unit had organised that, and the local community got to the point of wanting to have their kids partake in that, which was marvellous. We're in the Green Barrier. We actually got called a Catholic regiment one time because we were wearing green, which was quite amusing. And we lacked, obviously, the means to transport all these kids to this little summer camp thing for it. Can't really take them with 4 tons or military vehicles, for God's sake, they'd be a target. So we asked the police to help out. And the Royal Ulster Constabulary didn't decide to hire civilian coaches. They sent half a dozen coaches with Royal Ulster Constabulary written down the side. At which point, most of the parents wouldn't let the kids even go. Wouldn't even let the kids go. There was no way were they, as a fairly staunch Catholic Republican, they were going to allow their children to travel in a Royal Ulster Constabulary coach. And basically, the whole thing fell flat on its face. And it was just an example of the, I suppose, the muted bigotry of individuals in the police who just couldn't be bothered to actually get some decent normal buses. That's all we needed. You know, this statement had to be made, which, of course, they probably knew what the outcome was going to be anyway when they did it.
That seems quite a step, though, for a British unit to be able to do with the hearts and minds in Northern Ireland, because it's quite a transient situation over there a lot of times.
Look, I think it was. I mean, and like I say, it was only my first tour, so I had nothing prior to that to base it on, although I got the impression from some of the other guys have been around a bit longer, that there was a type of thing they'd try and do in a number of different situations. And then you got the guys who even saw further back before my time about Aidan and places where they, you know, again, comparable things like that, hearts and minds have been there. So unless it's a full-blown shooting match, I mean, you actually do try and win over the local population, perhaps, to make the job easier. It makes the job much easier if people are partly on your side.
What was the area like?
Well, coming from Merseyside, it wasn't that difficult to equate a lot of it. Council houses, some extremely run-down council houses, very, very industrial. I mean, there was all this sort of smog over Belfast generally anyway, and it was gloomy was the only impression I'm getting. It always seemed to be wet and miserable, and little old council houses and wet cobble streets and things. And I guess just like home when I grew up, I suppose, in that sense, I could see the same thing. But yeah, quite depressing actually.
And where were you accommodated?
We were in porter cabins in a compound at Glasmullen. Which wasn't even part of the police station like some of them were. It was really just this wriggly tin compound they put up and put all these porter cabins inside and said, there you go guys, this is where you live. Yeah, pretty basic.
Can you describe that a little bit more to me, what the camp was like?
Well, if you can imagine, say, some of the, the average size of, say, a school playground or something like that, put a wriggly tin fence around it, put some rocket wire up higher than that, put sangers at the corners on towers, watchtowers on the corners, have a sandbag main gate. Inside, there's just the tarmac hard standing on all these porter cabins. You know, there'd be the one that was the command post and where the radio setup and all the rest of it would be, and you know, the TQ would have his stores and a couple more, and then the number of the rest of them really split down just to be accommodation for the guys from the company. You know, double-sized bunk beds, I think, or three. Doubles, I think, but... And you go in a porter cabin and there'll be... You know, you get the whole section, the whole troop, and one of them all in bunk beds. Very little locker space and things, so you can imagine the kit you've got with you, and it's like living out of a suitcase for 6 months, because that's effectively what you're doing. But, of course, the corps doesn't allow you to sort of get slack and just have things lying around, so you get some order to it, and you try to make it a little bit like home, but it's... You never get a moment's peace. There's no privacy, that's for sure.
And did you come under fire in the camp as well?
Twice. First one was just a couple of rounds of a rifle was fired at one of the sangers at the front. I mean, that was anywhere near it. It was just one of those sort of things that happened. It was almost like a Saturday night pastime, I think, for some of the yahoos with guns who perhaps weren't even real terrorists. Just take a pot shot at the barracks, so to speak. Didn't hurt anyone, didn't cause any issue there at all. The second one was actually more amusing because it was internal. And a bloke was doing, it wasn't his fault. They were doing drills with the 84mm anti-tank weapon that we have, the thing that looks like a bazooka. Because we used to use that with an inert round to knock open the boots of suspect vehicles. You stand back for that thing hits it, knocks the boot open, and if it goes bang, well, there was a bomb. If it doesn't go bang, well, the bomb disposal guy is going to have a closer look. And that's what they were doing. They were supposed to be practicing. But the problem was, some of these supposed inert rounds were from manufacture, had actually been wrongly stenciled, and they weren't. So you've got the absolute live round, and then you've got an inert round, and you've got another one, it's called a practice round. And the practice round actually doesn't go bang at the far end, but it does actually launch a projectile at the front of them. And this is what happened. So our lads out there happily doing this down in one part of the yard that we're all in, and there's an almighty bang. And this projectile, which is, thank God, it's never going to go bang, launched itself and went through about three different porter cabins. Missed one guy, literally was lying on his bed in his upper bunk, and it came about 6 inches above him. This stuffing grey hole got knocked on the side of the porter cabin. You just laugh later, but God, it was funny at the time.
And what were your duties at that time, main duties?
Mainly because of still being with the radio side and the communication side. I'd go out on patrol with the company commander or the company sergeant major and their respective rover groups, we call them, twin land rover patrols, and do mobile patrols with them. We went out doing that, sometimes get seconded to one of the troops for different ops, and they wanted a better comms than just the ordinary rifleman doing it. And rest of the time working watches within the command post in the centre itself. So you're on watch and you'd have a duty officer or one of the seniors with you who really, well, effectively in control of all the patrols you've got out in the street, manoeuvring them, responding to their requests, perhaps guiding them if there's an incident they need to respond to, and so on and so forth. It's quite funny. You know, it's quite hard work, but it's quite funny on occasions.
With the mobile patrols, was it in Land Rovers?
Land Rovers, yes. In those days, we got to the point where the Macrolon Land Rovers had started to appear, the ones with the hard tops and things, but it was still a sort of crossover phase, and certainly they'd done some in just normal canvas top Land Rovers. In fact, even open top ones, once they decided that canvas was in the way, and so you sat open in the back of a Land Rover, really just driving around.
Is there a sense of vulnerability?
Yes. Yes, there probably is. There's probably been shooting matches that come later in life than that that were probably more wary of a situation like that. And I think we didn't feel that threatened all the time. We did that particular tour. It wasn't that threatening. There were certain episodes and incidents for sure, but there was no. It was quiet enough. It wasn't like every corner you went round you expected to get shot at.
Were there specific areas within your area of control that were particularly dangerous or particularly threatening? And how did that contrast with the other areas? Were they slap bang next to each other, or
They probably lay just intermingled. I mean, it was very hard to define. The TAOR for the company encompassed Leonardoon and name of the other place is escaping out of the little suburb, but they just really merged, and it was all predominantly Republican, therefore ergo Catholic in the way they define it. So it was a green area very much, but some parts were great. I mean, you had people, older people especially, were out maybe doing a vehicle checkpoint somewhere, and you're static for some period of time. We still had some of the older folk would bring out a cup of tea and things like that. I mean, most definitely. But to be perfectly honest, there are others like a few streets away, and you're moving to a different part of the suburb, they wouldn't give you the time of the day, you know. I mean, even if you asked them nicely, they just didn't want to know you. And women quite often were the worst of the lot with those sort of areas. I mean, outside of the direct threat of terrorists, kids are just kids, you just tell them to fuck off and leave it at that. But women, you know, it was hard to see a woman of an age that could have been my mother sort of routine and tell you what you bastards or something or other and use language that you wouldn't have expected come out of their voice. And you think, well, that's either just the nature of what they are, or there's something ingrained, there's maybe some commitment to what they actually feel and believe is should be happening, you know. So you probably felt more vulnerable in that sort of area, because also it would be the one where when they didn't come out and shout at you, all of a sudden nobody was on the streets, or they're there and they start disappearing, start wondering what's going to happen, because that's normally when someone's probably going to have a crack at you. There was a well-organised sort of underground aspect of the pre-signalling when an event, as they call it, was going to take place.
And these were directed, were they, by the IRA?
Oh, look, undoubtedly. I mean, I think there would be no question of the fact that the IRA were behind any of the operations in our area. There were a couple of, I remember rightly, and some of the tours now possibly started to merge in my mind in Northern Ireland. I've done obviously more than one tour, but there certainly, I think we probably did have maybe an intersectarian murder of some description. It was UDA Protestant terrorists that come in and actually shot a known IRA bloke and this type of thing. Those sort of things happened as well.
What were the kind of incidents that you'd face on a day-to-day basis? You said there was some certain riots, but would you have stonings or abuse or that sort of thing?
I think on day-to-day, and what, really and honestly, it's the old story about any form of operation, there's sort of large degrees of boredom interspersed with short periods of activity. And really and honestly, that time of 75 onwards from my other tours, it was never full on day on day on. It was something that happened quite more often the weekends or late at night if something was going to happen. During the day, I mean, apart from all these armoured Land Rovers and blokes with guns walking around and stuff, you know, it was really another suburban community, and I'm sure many of them were going about their normal business. So it was very difficult to say that there would be problems every day. And Irish terrorism was always very much anniversary dependent. And something we very quickly had picked up on, and if there was an anniversary of anything coming along that A, they possibly could deem a successful event they had previously, then you could almost anticipate that they'd be trying something else. It's like it was a lucky day to do things, so we'll do it again type of attitude. And that happened. That happened a fair few times. We could predict them, you know.
Were you bound by rules of engagement should something have happened?
Very much so. Two cards predominantly carried in those days, as we'd done in Cyprus, actually, funnily enough, on the operation there. Yellow card and white card. White card was to do with rules of talking to people and all the rest of it. The yellow card basically is the rules for engagement, and obviously the primary one, drummed into you through the training you do pre-Northern Ireland and carried on you all times. In fact, it was an offence not to carry it on you. in which it clearly defines the manner in which you might use your weapon as lethal force in a certain situation, and the procedure you must have gone through prior to that to make sure, are you shouting warnings and this type of thing, unless the situation is obviously totally different. About you don't expect to shout back when the man has actually stood there shooting at you, but certainly in terms of all those operations. It's also the other part of all that, and I think it was on the white card, which were your powers of arrest, which were actually tremendous, because they, every British soldier that served over there had more powers of arrest than the average bobby. All you had to do was say, as a member of Her Majesty's Forces, I arrest you. And you had to have probable cause or anything. You didn't like the look of this bloke, well, let's arrest him. I'm not saying that happened a lot, because a lot of paperwork come after when a lot of nausea, but certainly it gave you a lot of power when you wanted to stop a situation. Because some of the situations that you when you step out of vulnerability and feeling threatened, there were fights at pubs and clubs after hours, you know, and things like that that maybe get misinterpreted, potentially some sort of event going to take place, some riot maybe, and you rock up there and the police have come with you as well, and of course before you know it, you're actually involved in the policeman's job of dispersing the crowd, and when gobby Irishman doesn't want to get gone, well, you can get gone in the back of my bloody armoured car and we're going to take you to jail that way. Yeah.
Did you face a lot of sort of daily abuse, because you did say something, you mentioned a little about the women sometimes.
I wouldn't say daily. In some respects, the people immediately around the camp were actually quite grateful it was there, because although they were, I suppose, a little bit at risk of ever an attack against us taking place, I think in the general sort of skullduggery that would be going on just a short period away, linked IRA and everything, obviously, but some of the sort of underworld type aspect of that organisation, the standover tactics and so on and so forth, these people that live quite close to us actually felt secure that, because obviously Paddy wasn't going to come and cause issues right on the camp. He might want to attack him, but he wasn't going to. So those people nearby were quite friendly, and we used to go on reasonably well with them. You got to recognise them after a while. Look, a lot of the other people now, you actually could talk to them. It's the small enclaves you went into that you knew were a little bit more hard, and you just expect people to, you know, have a gobble for you.
What would the sort of composition of an average patrol that you'd be involved in be, really?
Patrols would normally be of section strength, and quite probably have multiple, what we call multiples out there. So you've got a section of 8 or 9 men moving down one particular route through various streets and things. You'd have another element of the multiple running somewhere in parallel or on other streets heading the same direction, or maybe the other patrol's a mobile patrol, so 2 Land Rovers worth, basically. And again, it's a section of strength. And they might be on a route that sort of intersperses with yours. So at some point, you actually sort of cross. You're on foot, and the mobile comes through and heads off a different direction. Half the object of the patrolling and the patrol patterns and plans that had to be pushed out, and they got to be quite complex on occasions, was to try to have no real predictability to where you were always going, but have enough resources on the ground that if something happened, you hopefully could respond quickly enough to get to the relevant area. Yeah.
And is there a style in which a patrol, say a foot patrol, would be organised? Are you a certain length apart?
Yeah.
Is it something that you're always watching? That sort of thing I'm trying to get at.
Oh, look, in that sense, yeah, and it's down to basic soldiering skills. It's sort of, when you're doing a tour like that in Belfast, as opposed to South Armagh or one of the others, then you're really doing urban warfare. That's the sort of thing you're doing. And the training pre-Northern Ireland, I mean, they probably do 4 or 5 months pre-Northern Ireland training. So you've got lots of time to practice this back in Seaton Barracks, wandering around there as if it's an Irish town or whatever. So you get reasonably skilled. Yes, you've got to stay apart. You don't want to bunch up. You know, people have got to check the rear. You've got to be alert both upstairs, downstairs, strange doorways, round corners. And unlike, for example, say fighting in a built-up area as a conventional warfare strategy, of course you're in a community where there's people out in the streets and normal things happening. There isn't necessarily a direct threat at that point in time, and you have to accommodate that. It's difficult going along a street when there's people on that street and there are shops and people, prams and cars and everything else, trying to keep comms with your blokes and where they are can be quite challenging sometimes.
And what are you wearing on a patrol?
usual sort of standard everyday dress. I mean, of course, being Royal Marines, we wear denims rather than the DPM camouflage suits, but flak jackets, which in those days were a little bit more primitive than the current ones. Reasonably heavy, wouldn't stop a great deal, but we knew that anyway. And normally a belt or the ammunition pouches, water bottle, first aid kits in your pockets, wearing your beret. We wouldn't wear helmets. The only time we ever wore helmets was in an actual riot situation. Failing that, we, you know, it's the profile basically you've got to display, and people know who you are. If you don't look, to try to look a little bit less menacing, maybe as well, you know. And of course, your rifle.
Is your rifle attached at all? So, in case of loss or.
Yeah, you normally take the sling, and rather than have it on the forestock, you take it from the butt, and the other bit goes around your wrist. So it's looped to your wrist. So, as you rightly say, if it gets grabbed, it can't be grabbed away from you. I mean, even that's thought through, so it's not. Leave the attachment on the stock of the rifle around your wrist, because of course if someone pulls out your hand away from you, you'll be going with it, and of course as it turns around, it's going to be the muzzle that's going to be facing you rather than the other way around. Well, of course if they grab it, then they're not going to get very far with it.
And searching, were you involved in searching?
Involved in search operations, I mean, everyone gets, I mean, as with most things in Royal Marine training of any description, I mean, everyone goes through the pre-Northern Ireland training for searching and how to and all the bits and pieces and potential booby traps and so on and so forth. As the radio op on any of these sort of operations we're doing, of course, most of my issue would have been the communication side. So if I go inside, it's my I'm responsible for ensuring the comms from the search team and everything to the outside is working. But a lot of the time, to be fair, I'd probably be outside with the cordon and controlling or helping control elements of the cordon and the search that's in progress at the time.
How would that work? Would a cordon be established and then the search occur, or is there a different pattern to that?
They varied. Again, probably not to do patterns. I mean, I've known a search team rock up at the front door of a house and not quite knocking it down, but that was it's a fairly cursory banging on the door, open up, and they do knock it down, and they sort of arrive to do that as almost at the same time the cordon's rocking up at the various points which are going to set checkpoints and be there. And then on other occasions, yeah, as you rightly say, I mean, sometimes after an incident, more likely, the incident's probably been responsive, but you get the cordon and then the search team's pulled through to go and examine. Bit like soccer going through a crime scene afterwards, sort of routine.
As a radio operator, when you were out on the streets in Belfast, would you potentially have been a target because of the fact that you're carrying a radio, as opposed to another member of the patrol, potentially?
Oh, look, there's always been an argument that's the case. I mean, the bloke with the antenna sticking out the back of his pack or whatever tends to be a little bit more obvious for a start-off, and he's the one that's got to carry this big lump of kit around, the rest of the guys haven't got to. So, yeah, I mean, in pure military terms, yeah. I mean, if you're looking at taking out an opposing force of some description, well, whoever's in charge, if they're making that obvious by waving their hands around and everyone seems to be deferring to one individual that's there, the leader, well, he's a target. And yeah, normally the other bloke with the comms will be a target. Lose comms and hope for that patrol or whatever is a bit more isolated.
If you're going out on patrol from the barracks, is there a technique for leaving? Because I say that would be a vulnerable moment.
It is. I mean, the start and finish of any patrol is the most dangerous. Techniques would vary, depend on the various alert stages. But you obviously load up in the loading bay before you go out of the gates, and sort of once everyone's ready to go, then it tends. I mean, you've got Sangha sentries guarding you as well, and you're observing down the street. And the gate is open, and the first couple of guys would get out and probably, for hard targeting, as they call it, then you run dodge and weave across the street and take up positions, and then the next two come out and leapfrog you and so on and so forth to get your foot on the ground. There's been tours on situations though where that wasn't the case, and it's been actually a safe enough area, for want of a better word, that you can actually more or less just go straight out on the patrol. Yeah.
What about returning? Is there a technique for
very similar to actually leaving. Again, if you're coming back in and you've been hard targeting throughout, then you've staged impersonally back into the place, so set up a little perimeter near the place. The sentries know you're there. They're obviously observing their arcs, and everyone's checking there's nothing going to happen at this point in time, and then Imperials run Tiger back inside and unload the weapon. Breathe a sigh of relief.
How long was it, Tom?
6 months in those days.
So you did a 6 month period. Was it a strain living under those conditions for that period of time?
Yeah, look, 6 months away can be. I have to be honest, that's all. I did 4.5 months and came back. I went on a junior command course, but I've done subsequent tours of 6 months over there. And yes, it does get to be a strain after a while, because you're in everyone else's space. There's no private space. And, oh, look, even the blokes can get a bit hacked off about something, you know, married lad or guy with a girlfriend or something, there's problems at home, things of that nature. You know, it can sway the mood of a section of blokes living together sometimes. He's depressed and, you know, you've got to try and pick him up, and you know, you've still got your patrol program to go with and all the rest of it, and just try to keep him happy and good spirits, or he'll drag the rest of you down in terms of despondency and this sort of thing.
So you returned to the UK to do a junior leaders course. Was that the move for you?
Yeah, I hocked up about it a little bit. My sergeant came and told me that I was going on the next junior command course. I said, when's that? Next Tuesday, you're off. I said, I'm not even a Lance Corporal yet. And he went, that's being sorted tomorrow. I said, oh, great. I said, well, I don't want to go. I'm enjoying this. This is because it was the first time in Ireland. And he said, listen, son, just go and do it. They don't ask you twice normally. So, yeah, I ended up, I did about four and a half months of that particular tour, and by the time they got from Ireland and got their Northern Ireland leave, which I didn't get, because I was already at Limston on this junior command course.
What did the course involve?
It's 9 weeks worth, basically, of supposedly turning into a junior NCR corporal, or the battalion, qualified to be promoted to corporal anyway, let's put it that way. In those days, the course was split between the 6 weeks, which was for all specialist qualifications. That was the basic junior command course itself. So guys that were drivers or clerks or chefs or whomever, all did that help. The course there is, it's predominantly about leadership. It's teaching you more stuff on the drill square about how you can take charge of bodies of men. There's more tactics. There's more understanding of military law and how to apply it, because now you're going to have the blank to possibly have to do that. It's good general sort of stuff. And then the final 3 weeks in those days was called the Rifle Section Commander's Course. So all the blokes like me who were either riflemen or, even though I was with a radio op, as I said, it's an ad qual, so therefore I'm not a specialist to signal, I'm actually really just an ordinary rifleman. So all those guys in that sort of sphere go and do 3 weeks. That was hard bloody work. That was out of count nearly all the time on exercise, really putting into practice how to lead what's going to be your section of guys potentially in the future in the field on various forms of operations. It's very good though.